Hello and welcome to Bone Up, the podcast all about bones, how we make them, why we break them, and if we fully understand them. I'm David Armstrong.
Hi, and I'm Richie Abel. And over this series, we're going to be exploring osteoporosis, bones, what we know and what we're yet to discover. And we hope you will join us on the journey.
So for anyone keen to learn more about our infrastructure of calcified collagen, this is Bone Up. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Bone Up, what we believe will be the last episode for 2025, and also the first episode of Series 4. It's hard to believe we're now in Series 4, Richie.
Oh, it's incredible. To think we've done, just over 30 episodes now. When we first started this and we were discussing, you know, how many should we try, we thought we'd do 6. And that nobody would listen and then that we would stop. So thank you, everybody. Really appreciate your listening to the podcast and really appreciate your support. And we'll keep going because, you know, it's a lot of fun. And I really enjoy making this podcast with you, David. It's been a lot of fun and we've learned a lot along the way. It really has been a nice journey.
It's great. And I mean, we hope this is a sort of a repository of knowledge in some ways about, you know, clinical bone disease and about bone research. And I know some of our listeners dip in and out to episodes that they're interested in, and others have followed us all the way from the start right to the where we are now. So everyone's welcome.
We are the podcast of record for bone research.
So the end of another year, Richie, always a bit of a roller coaster. How have things been for you?
It's been a good year this year. We got a couple of grants, and earlier in the year, we had a really good paper out in a journal called Progress in Material Science. It was a collaboration with MIT, and basically it sets out a vision for bone research for the next decade or so. And essentially, we've got a lot of people who are studying bone using experiments and a lot of people who are studying bone by building computer models. And actually, bone is such a complex material and has such a complex physiology that really we need to combine those two approaches together. So we wrote a paper about how you would go about combining modeling approaches and experimental approaches together to unlock new knowledge about bone. And I hope that, you know, we're going to be able to support osteoporosis research. And I also hope that maybe this new type of research is also going to be really good for studying rare bone diseases like osteogenesis imperfecta, diseases that happen across scales in bone, and that really we don't know that much about the physiology of the disease and why the bones break, which is really exciting.
Yeah, that's really important. I mean, there's a lot we discover about bones, I suppose, through the door of osteoporosis, but then it applies to other diseases. And even though those diseases, as you say, are rare, one of the things that you always learn as a medical student is that common things are common, but many people have rare diseases. And I certainly have a surprising number of people with rare bone diseases come to see me at the clinic. So it's great to hear that, you know, you're looking into the future and maybe establishing a roadmap to encourage other researchers as well.
Yeah, I really hope that we have done that, and I hope people read it and cite it, and that we can drum up a bit of support for new research. How was your year?
It's been a busy year. You tend sort of clinically, I think you tend to go through phases where you're out advertising osteoporosis, explaining the importance of people being sent up to the hospital if they have vertebral fractures. And then you go through periods where you're overwhelmed by the amount of work you have to do because you've got all these new patients and you've got all these exciting new drugs. So it always goes up and down a bit. It's been a very busy year. We've had really the new NOG guidance out now this year. It's the 2024 guidance, but it's been on the website and used not just in the UK, but many people from around the world, I think, do read the NOG guidance, and it was good to be a small part of that. And on a personal level, as you know, Richie, our son James was married earlier in the year, and James is the official illustrator and artist of the podcast. although because we don't pay him, he still has to work as an architect. So it was great. It was great to be at the wedding in August, and very best wishes to him and Sophie from all here at Bone Up, I think we can say.
Congratulations.
And of course, I did meet a few doctors at the wedding who, believe it or not, were listeners to the podcast. So that was sort of encouraging as well.
It's surprising, isn't it, when you're out and about, how many people you meet who listen to it. It's really good. And thank you all for tuning in. It really helps us to keep going.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was just doing a clinic this morning, an osteoporosis clinic, getting patients started on new drugs. And, you know, one of the things people do ask is about new drug development and, I suppose, why it takes so long to get drugs to the market. I do sometimes explain to patients that I've been to conferences, I've heard about drugs in development. It seems ages and ages until we actually can get it, you know, get it into the clinic. And we have an excellent guest for our episode today. Very exciting. I think we're both really excited to speak to our guest today.
Yeah.
And she has done some work in this area, which is not discovering a new drug, not discovering a new screening program, but discovering a different way of doing research and a different way of analyzing research, which may be a complete game changer going forward. Isn't that right? Richie, because one of the problems we have is to show a new drug works, you have to show it reduces fractures. And that can take a long time and a lot of patience.
Literally a lot of patience. And therein lies the problem.
Yeah.
So listeners, you know that if a drug is going to be approved for use in people, it has to go through a clinical trial. And the clinical trials have to show that using the drug to treat people improves their outcomes, improves their health. And obviously, when we're talking about osteoporosis, the thing that everybody worries about is fractures and preventing fractures. Clinical trials in osteoporosis have to demonstrate that a medicine reduces the risk that people will sustain a fracture. And that's actually very hard to do. First of all, fractures are relatively rare, which means that you have to run the trial for a long time and to have many, many people in the trial in order to be able to detect a reduction in the risk of a fracture. And that means that the trials are very expensive, which is bad for the companies running them, and also really, really long, which is bad for patients because it means everybody has to wait longer to get new medicines. And the real kicker is that if a trial has to be long and have a lot of patients in it, you're going to get a lot of dropout along the way. You know, not everybody can make it to the end of the trial. You lose people, they move home, they change the contact details, which means you've got to stack up a trial with even more people to make sure that you get through to the end with enough people to be able to compare your treatment group, say, with a placebo group. And that's really, really difficult to do. We need ways to get drugs to patients more quickly.
And so if there was only a way that we could prove drugs were effective at reducing fractures without having to wait years and years and years for lots of people in the trial to have fractures.
I think this is a really good time to introduce our next guest for today. Welcome, listeners, back for another episode of Bone Up. Today, I'm really pleased to announce we've got an excellent guest for you, Professor Mary Buckstein. Professor Buckstein is the Maurice E. Mueller Professor of Orthopaedic Surgery at Harvard Medical School, a leader in the world of osteoporosis research and somebody I've looked up to for many years as I've been doing my research. Past president of the ASBMR, the American and also International Bone Society in the world, co-lead of the study to advance BMD as a regulatory endpoint, SABRE, which we're going to be talking about today. And this could be a really big bang moment in the search for new and better osteoporosis treatments. Welcome, Mary.
Welcome, Mary. Thank you for making the time to speak to us and indeed wrestling with the technology so that we're all in the same room at the same time today.
Thank you both. It's really a pleasure to be here and I look forward to this conversation.
Oh, wonderful. Mary, you're somebody really wanted to interview since we got the podcast started a few years ago. We're really pleased to have you here. I just want to get started with something that might surprise some of our listeners. You're one of the world's leading experts in bone health and bone health research, and you're working to change clinical guidelines, but actually you're an engineer.
What drew an engineer to study bones?
Oh, that's such a great question. Thank you for that. So you're right. I have my undergraduate and graduate degrees in engineering, mechanical engineering. When I finished undergraduate, I also have a degree in economics. And the original plan was to get an MBA and go into business with this engineering degree and make lots of money. And I had an internship one summer and a desk job in an office, and I found it dreadfully boring. And so when I finally finished undergrad, I started looking at graduate school. And at that time, the field of biomechanics and bioengineering was relatively new. And that really appealed to me because I was always fascinated by the human body, but I didn't really want to become a doctor or a physician. And so I applied to graduate school, and just literally by chance, I ended up with a project that was related to the effects of exercise on bone health. And that resonated with me so much. I joined the group at Stanford, and I was super fortunate to have co-advisors as an endocrinologist, Dr. Robert Marcus, and my engineering advisor, Dennis Carter. And I think that set me off on this path of studying bone health.
Amazing. I didn't realize you'd done economics as well.
Yeah, it's probably very relevant actually to the world we live in today in terms of new drugs as well, isn't it? You've got all the right background. I mean, one of the things we wanted to talk to you today was about the SABRE project. And anyone who has worked either as a clinician or as a scientist, I think, in looking at development of new drugs is aware that what we've been interested in up to now is fracture as an outcome. So we're only interested if the new drug prevents fractures or reduces the risk of fractures. Tell us how the SABRE project has changed that or has aimed to change that, if you would.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. Maybe as you know, this has really been a passion project. I wrote the first paper on using surrogate endpoints in osteoporosis trials in 2008. And we started the SABRE project in 2013. And you're correct that up until now, to show that new treatments are effective for osteoporosis, our clinical trials have to wait until fractures to occur. And that, as you are aware, and I'm sure your listeners are aware, requires pretty large and pretty long and then thus fairly expensive studies. And that has really inhibited innovation in the field. And so what we aim to do was use data from this large database, and we can talk about this, to show that the change in bone density measured by a standard non-invasive test that we're all familiar with, DEXA, could accurately predict the impact of treatments on fracture risk. And we have been able to do that, and we can talk more about that. But I really think that by streamlining drug development, hopefully this landmark decision we hope to hear very soon will spur more discovery, innovation, and investment in the osteoporosis field.
And were you able to relate changes in bone mineral density directly to percentage changes in fracture risk? Was it as clear as that?
Yes, absolutely. So maybe take one step back and talk a little bit about the data we were able to acquire. So I think importantly, we were very fortunate to have the support of the Foundation for the NIH, which is a group that facilitates public-private partnerships. And we were fortunate to have a number of companies, over 10 companies, gave their data to allow to this database so that we could do these analyses. And we ended up with over 160,000 individual patients with bone mineral density and fracture outcomes from 52 different trials with 16 different mechanisms of action for the drugs. And so it's a really robust data set to be able to ask the question, does a change in bone density predict the fracture outcomes?
And was there any difference between different drugs? Because we have a lot of interest, you know, in how osteoanabolics work differently from anti-resorptives. So does increasing your bone mineral density with an osteoanabolic, for example, does that prevent further fractures to a greater or lesser degree than increasing it with an anti-resorptive, my patient might ask?
Exactly. That's a super great question. You may be familiar with the fact that we don't have that many osteoanabolic trials. So we have three trials in our data set. And so we cannot do a specific analysis by drug. We were able to look at anti-resorptive therapies versus all therapies and show that all of the therapies basically fall on the same regression line, meaning they have the same relationship between this change in BMD and the fracture risk reduction. So it was very reassuring that whether you were an osteoanabolic drug with a very large change in BMD and a very large reduction in fracture, or a SERM, selective estrogen receptor modulator, lower increase in BMD and smaller effect on fracture, that we were able to generalize this relationship across classes of drugs. And of course, that's very important because you want to be able to use this for future trials where there may be different mechanisms of action that we haven't studied yet. So I think the generalizability is very important.
Mary, the data set you analyzed for SABRE was enormous. Did the study throw up any surprises?
You know, not really. I would say everything has actually been pretty reassuringly predictable in that larger increases in BMD are associated with greater reductions in fracture risk. I think a few of the smaller trials, like real small trials that may have been from the phase two studies where they weren't sufficiently powered for fracture endpoints, we have a few outliers there, but none of the larger trials that actually had enough subjects with appropriate number of fractures, there were no surprises there.
Were there any differences between different parts of the body? Because again, this is something, you know, patients will ask me. So is there a greater predictive value, let's say, at the spine than at the hip? Or, you know, we often, as you know, hip BMD is quite predictive of sort of the general risk of fracture, which is something I always remind patients. Does increasing BMD at the hip, for example, reduce your risk of a forearm fracture? Or was that data not, could you not get that from the data?
That's an excellent question. We looked at all BMD sites, so total hip, femoral neck, and lumbar spine. And not all the trials had all of those because our trials are, you know, some of them are 30 years old, right? But there was, spine did not necessarily perform better than hip. And we chose the total hip because it has high reproducibility, which you want in this kind of study. And it had a strong association with all fracture types. So to your point, spine did a little bit better for predicting the effect on vertebral fractures, but total hip, the change in total hip bone density was able to predict fractures at the spine, non-vertebral fractures, and hip fractures.
That's interesting. It seems almost slightly counterintuitive sometimes, or certainly when you're explaining this to patients, but it's really good that that came out of this data sort of as well.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember when we're thinking about, you know, the goal of the SABRE project is to advance regulatory methodology, not necessarily to use these data for interpreting changes in an individual patient. So the important thing when I say change in BMD, we are really talking about the difference between the increase in BMD in the treated group versus the change in BMD in the placebo group. So we're not talking about a change from baseline in an individual patient. Rather, our change in BMD refers to the difference between the treatment group and the placebo group. And I think that's really important to keep in mind in interpreting the SABRE outcomes.
Thinking about what this is going to mean for the world of osteoporosis, you mentioned at the very beginning that osteoporosis trials are complicated and long. How will using BMD as a surrogate help companies and scientists develop new treatments?
Great question. So what we think and what we have proposed to the regulatory agency, the FDA, is that BMD could be used as the primary endpoint. And that is going to mean a smaller trial and perhaps a shorter trial. Our data suggests that the 2-year change in BMD works really well, and that the 18-month change in BMD also works pretty good. A 12-month change in BMD didn't seem to work, have quite as strong an association. So I think that companies who are considering developing new therapeutics will be able to do trials that will be smaller. They'll still be 2 years or 18 months to 2 years in duration. And that will be a lot easier than waiting for fractures to occur. I mean, the last very large trial that was done, odanacatib, had almost 15,000 patients in it. So we think that at a minimum, you will need to have 500 patients, perhaps, in order to show this that the change in BMD can predict the fracture outcome.
Wow, so that's a startling reduction in the length of the trial, the number of participants that have to be recruited in, I guess, the overall cost of the study as well. And ultimately, listeners, I guess this is going to mean that potentially drugs can be tested more quickly and get approved more quickly and get to patients more quickly.
Exactly.
Which is wonderful news.
And I must say, on reading the outcomes of this, of course, it struck me in the past, it was easier almost to prove fracture risk reduction when your placebo group was literally a placebo. Nowadays, ethically, it's much harder to do a study with a placebo because you can't leave someone with a new vertebral fracture on calcium and vitamin D for 3 or 4 years. So it's all, if you're just using fractures as an outcome, it's going to be harder to prove that. So it's brilliant that we have this now. We're getting so many new drugs. And the placebo arm is always going to be quite a good drug as well. I think that's one of the things I must think. It struck me as particularly useful and encouraging from this.
Also, I will point out, we have looked at, there aren't very many, but we've looked at the combination and sequential trials. So the trials that have an active comparator and or compared, you know, a sequential treatment. And fortunately, they also fall on the same regression line. And so it's very reassuring that the interpretation of a study, if a sponsor wanted to do a trial with an active control, so not using a placebo, that it you would be able to interpret the change in BMD or that the difference in BMD between the treatment group and now it's not a placebo group, it's an actively controlled group, should work the same. And that was also very reassuring, just sort of the robustness of this relationship. Maybe that's been the most surprising thing, that it continues to work so well.
One of the things I really like about the bone world is it really does seem to be at the cutting edge of a lot of science. Having gone through the experience of developing a biomarker that the FDA hopefully will approve as a surrogate, what have you learned? And do you think that your approach could be a blueprint for researchers working in other medical disciplines like dementia or heart disease, etc.? Would they also be able to copy what you've done and develop biomarkers as their endpoints?
Again, such a great question. I would say there's a few things related to that question. One is, I think that this whole effort shows the power and potential of this public-private partnership, and that the data sharing from clinical trials was essential for us to be able to do this. And hopefully it spurs others to also share data from clinical trials so that these types of analyses can be done in other areas. And then the second part is, yes, we will be the first ones to have gone through this formal regulatory process that was set up by the FDA actually in 2016. And ours will be the first efficacy endpoint to be approved using this process. And I think it will provide a blueprint for other therapeutic areas to follow along, maybe mimicking what we did, given they would have also similarly large data sets with a surrogate endpoint or a biomarker and the clinical endpoint.
That's amazing. Listeners, another world-leading example of bone research that can have impact well beyond bone and on other diseases as well. It's really nice to hear.
I'm going to ask a sort of devil's advocate question because I'm from Belfast and we like stirring things up, as you know. I mean, you're from an engineering background. You've done work, you know, I was looking back at some of your older papers on QCT and imaging modalities which look at quality of bone. And something on the podcast here, we've talked a lot about this over the years about elasticity of bone and hydration of bone and how the things that go to increasing your risk of fracture are not all contained within bone mineral density, these other things as well. Is there a chance that if we focus now purely on increases in bone mineral density, that new treatments which may improve bone quality may find it harder to get in, or that people will say, well, we're not interested in improving bone quality unless it improves bone mineral density, if that becomes our sort of only marker?
Again, a really excellent question. You know, we've thought a lot about that. And of course I have, because this has been my active area of research for decades, right?
I hope the FDA aren't listening and ask you that question next week.
Yeah, no problem. usually it's the other way around. Okay. So, and I will come back to your question, but let me diverge for a second. Usually it's the other way around. Like, what about a drug that improves BMD but has a bad effect on bone quality or doesn't improve bone strength? So then you would approve something that folks would take and it's actually not good for their bone. That would not be good. And so the one way that we think that won't happen is that the regulatory requirements will stay the same for preclinical studies, so animal studies, to show that the increase in bone density is associated with an increase in bone strength. And the classic example where that didn't work so well was fluoride treatment. So again, several decades ago, fluoride increased bone density, but did not have any effect on reducing fracture risk. And when you go back and look, the preclinical data would have shown that. So the rabbit studies and rat studies had increases in BMD, but no increase in the mechanical properties of the bone. And so we think that going forward with SABRE, that given a strong preclinical package in combination with showing that BMD increases in patients, that we can be reassured that drugs that are approved under this pathway will have positive effects on fracture risk. Okay, now to your other point, let's go back to that. It's a good question. If a new therapeutic improved bone quality but had a very limited effect on BMD, I think we would probably have a tough time getting it approved through this pathway. So that might be, you know, someone who would then want to do a fracture trial, and they could do a vertebral fracture trial, you know, which aren't as large as some of the other trials that have tried to show efficacy for hip fracture.
I was thinking just particularly, you know, sort of people with diabetes and this perception that the bone dent or the bones may be less elastic, there may be more collagen cross-linking, you may actually have higher BMD than you would expect. Let's say, you know, with all the developments in diabetes where we were able to potentially improve fracture risk, but it may not actually change BMD that much. So, but yeah, I think that's a fair, we can still go and do those other studies then is probably your answer to
that. Yeah, and we did show, even within the SABRE database, we looked at patients with diabetes. There are some in nearly every trial. And even within them, the change in bone density would predict fractures. And we also showed the efficacy of treatments broadly across patients with diabetes. So I think it would still work in that case. You know, whether I'm trying to think of an example, if we had anything that improves bone quality and has no effect on BMD. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. That doesn't mean that someone isn't working on it and that it might not come in the future. And then we'll have to think about it very carefully.
I suppose the original trial designs will still be there if somebody wants to use them.
Exactly.
Mary, when we looked at your papers and looked at your research across your career, you've done a lot of different things in your research. Studies of ex vivo bone samples to look at how structure and chemistry affected the strength. You're one of the pioneers of using new in vivo imaging techniques like
HRPQCT. Yeah.
That's the one. Team bone up there.
It's all right. He'll edit this bit out. If I make a mistake, Mary, he keeps it in. If he does, he edits it out. But there we
I
are.
Love that.
And you did in vivo studies of people looking at how bone density and bone structure related to their fractures. And you've also taken part in a lot of clinical research, clinical trials, development of new technologies, to use CT scans to diagnose people with osteoporosis opportunistically, etc. How do you fit all of this in? Did you have a clear trajectory at the beginning, like a plan that you wanted to work through step by step? Or did you sort of have to take things as they come? How did you navigate through all that?
Wow, that's a big question. I certainly did not have a clear plan. Let's just go with that. And I kind of followed where the research led me. And initially, I had started my PhD work was in human subjects and looking at the effects of exercise on bone. And then I went and I wanted to do some mechanistic studies. So then I learned how to do animal research. And then I came back to clinical research because I thought, well, that's really the really impactful stuff. And we need to be able to translate our animal work into humans. So it kind of has been a thread along the way to be able to combine both. But I can't say I had a specific path in mind. It's been a little bit just follow where the good science takes you and hopefully have an impact in the end.
It's interesting. Yeah, I very much got the feeling that you were following what you loved and enjoyed doing.
You know, and all this is so relevant. I literally, as I said to you, I've just finished a clinic this morning. I had a conversation with a patient in her 10th decade about exercise and about the benefits of exercise with bone. And she was very keen at doing this, you know, even though she was in her 90s. And I was explaining a little about the research that, you know, that was behind that. And I had a patient not long afterwards, and we were talking about the increase in bone mineral density and how, even though the SABRE study is not for individual patients, but how the patient could be reassured that the increase in bone mineral density in the real world would reduce her risk of having further fracture. And that sort of research, it's so relevant actually in the clinic and so relevant to patients, because patients love to hear that, you know, I'm not just inventing all this, it's actually coming from, you know, from research. And the work that you do is so relevant, you know, not just in Harvard or Imperial, but, you know, sitting here at outpatient clinics in Northern Ireland, seeing, you know, patients just coming in day to day with osteoporosis.
Well, it's really great to hear that, and has been a goal of mine all along. I can say, as we talked at the beginning, I fell into it, but I will say it has been incredibly rewarding to be in a field of predominantly women's health. Certainly men have osteoporosis as well, but to be able to support clinicians in this field, to have those difficult conversations with patients and motivate people to take care of their bone health. And I'm going to keep on that path as long as I can.
That's great. And why do we have more research on men with osteoporosis, Mary?
Why do we have more? Sorry, can you read?
Why do we not have more research on men with osteoporosis?
I actually think we have quite a bit of research more lately. The Mr. Oss study has done some fantastic studies looking at risk factors for fractures for osteoporosis.
No, I think, certainly you're lately. No, just thinking, looking back over the studies over the years, you know, you always have to end up saying to patients, of course, all these studies were done in women and not in men.
It's okay. We'll take it. You know, there's plenty of other examples that go the opposite. So, you know, it's all right for osteoporosis studies to be done in women. I'm not going to apologize for that. I think one thing maybe I'll bring up You know, in talking about my background, certainly one of my interests and passions has been understanding the non-BMD aspects of bone strength. And sort of this, the Sabre project is so focused on BMD, it seems to fly counter to a lot of my other research. And I think when we started the Sabre project, we also collected QCT scans from all the clinical trials. And I was very excited about that aspect of it. So we could use the 3D information. And certainly I thought we would have a better predictor. There are, in all of the phase 3 clinical trials, 800 CT scans in patients who've been treated with osteoporosis therapies with fracture outcomes. So as you can imagine, that pales in comparison to the 160,000 individuals who have BMD measurements by DEXA and fracture outcomes. So as much as I really wanted to look at that, the practical aspects of being able to do that analysis precluded moving forward with QCT as the outcome. So that being said, you know, so we move forward with BMD and it really applies, as I've tried to emphasize, to the regulatory pathway and the testing of new therapeutics in osteoporosis. Now, if we take a step back, the other thing we want to do is predict fracture risk in the individual patient. And there, I think we're still understanding how we can best use advanced imaging, ultrasound, water content to better identify someone who maybe has normal BMD or lowish BMD, but still might be at high risk of fracture because they have deteriorated microarchitecture or deficiencies in their bone quality. So I can still put the two together, even though they seem like they're very disparate areas of research.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, you seem to be such a champion almost of this, you know, looking at quality of bone. And now, I don't think they go against each other, but I just wondered, you thought, did it in any way sort of not undermine, but it was, you know, did it almost go against what you've done before? But we need to look at both, don't we? We need to look at quality and quantity.
Yeah, and so I think the way that the Sabre project works, having the preclinical data, ensuring that the new bone that's formed under a treatment is of good quality sort of fits together in the big paradigm. And then we think about how can we better identify individual patients who are at highest risk is where some of the more advanced technologies or, I mean, BMD does pretty well. I mean, we do have to admit that we have a very good biomarker for fracture risk and better than what's used in many other therapeutic areas. So let's be clear, but we'd always striving to do a little bit better and to really find the patient who, you know, should be treated with an osteoanabolic therapy or should be treated with an antiresorptive therapy. And having these additional tools, I think, is going to allow us to have more sensitivity and specificity in identifying those individual patients who should be on a treatment.
Yeah, we really do hope that it leads to new drugs and to getting new drugs regulatory approval more quickly so that I can get to use them in the clinic.
Exactly. Just think, imagine an oral osteoanabolic or, yeah, you know, an antiresorptive, a new antiresorptive therapy that people are not afraid of taking because they're not worried about the very rare side effects. So I think we have lots of very exciting bone biology. And with a new and more manageable regulatory pathway, we're already beginning to see investment and interest in the field, you know, sort of in developing these new therapies. So I think we're going to see some exciting things in the next few years.
It's really interesting that research into trial development is going to unlock new treatments and maybe have a bigger effect than some of the research into the basic physiology and mechanics that govern bone fractures. It's really wonderful to see that.
You know, it's interesting. It was a hypothesis that if we were able to be successful, that it would prompt this innovation and interest in new drug development. And, you know, to be quite honest, we're seeing it. We're seeing investors talking about osteoporosis again. and we're seeing interest in the investment space in osteoporosis. So it's happening. So we just need the FDA to come out with their ruling pretty soon. And then as another fact, we're not going to stop with the FDA. We are going to hopefully move to the European Regulatory Agency and also in Japan, because it's important not just to have it in the US.
Yeah, I went to San Francisco a few weeks ago, and there's a lot of investors who are very, very excited. They've kind of got their finger on the button, ready to go. They know that this could be a big bang moment. I'm keeping my fingers crossed for you that you get a positive decision back from the FDA. When you do, we're going to have like an emergency podcast, I think.
I was going to say, you're going to have to update the podcast with new information to add to the end of this when we hear from the FDA. Hopefully very soon.
We should record two different endings, Richie, a happy one and a sad one. You know the way to do with these things, and then edit them in depending on what happens.
Mary, it's been really lovely talking to you today. Thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure talking to you both, and I hope I was able to explain a little bit what Saber is about and what we hope it's going to do for the field.
Thank you, Mary. It's been great. Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of listeners are going to get in touch to say thank you for this episode. I think it's going to bring hope to a lot of people, not just people who have osteoporosis, who are living with the condition, but also to their families and future generations as well.
That is the hope. We have a big burden of this disease. We are currently under treating and under diagnosing, so we have some work to do. I also hope that the interest in women's health in general and the empowerment of women to have a bigger voice to take care of their own health is going to translate into taking care of their bone health. And I think we will see, hopefully, a greater interest in individual patients demanding new treatments, demanding information and better care for their bones.
Yeah, I think it's really important. We've talked a lot about this, about empowering our listeners and empowering people to ask for new treatments, because even still with osteoanabolics, a lot of it is still patient driven, you know, saying I've had a vertebral fracture, I need this treatment. So absolutely, more power to your elbow, as they say.
Yeah. And not to say that the treatments we have are not good and not effective. I think just always having more options for that conversation between the patient and the physician is going to be a good thing.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you both.
Wow, that was a really interesting discussion with Mary. And I always feel as we get to the end of these discussions, you know, we're cutting them short. There's so many other things that we could, you know, we could talk about and we could draw out. Of the things that Mary said today, Richie, which sort of stand out for you, or which do you think are most important for your practice?
I suppose the most important thing for me is just the inspiration. Mary comes across as a true visionary, one of the first to show that surrogate endpoints could be used in osteoporosis trials. Through Saber, Mary's taken that to quite an extraordinary scale, pooling data from 160,000 participants across dozens of trials and many mechanisms of action is an enormous task. And listening to Mary describe the science, the regulatory processes, the public-private collaborations behind Saber, it was clear to me how much determination and persistence this must have taken from Mary and the whole Saber team. I think what really struck me is, despite the magnitude of this work, Mary's really grounded in people. During the interview, Mary talked about ethics, equity, data sharing, creating more options for conversations between patients and clinicians. Goal always seemed to be getting better and safer treatments to patients sooner. I've listened back to the episode a couple of times now, and every time I listen back, I catch something new. There's another insight, another layer to what Mary was saying. And I just keep coming away with more and more appreciation for her work and her vision and really her values. it's something that we see again and again in these podcasts when we're talking to the really top people in Bone. They're fighting for people and they're fighting for equity and they're not doing this for themselves. And that's really wonderful. What were your takeaways?
You know, one thing I was reflecting, I think afterwards, we talk a lot about communication and how important it is as a doctor, as a research scientist, to be able to communicate with patients. I realize how important it is to be able to communicate with the people who pay for drugs, with commissioners, with politicians, with government. You have to be able to communicate the need for drugs, the devastating effect osteoporosis has, and the potential benefits of getting new drugs online more quickly, and how, you know, Mary can go from being in the lab doing that sort of work to making presentations to the FDA, and how those both are very important in getting drugs to the patient. It's not just the science, but it's communicating that science to, you know, as I say, to commissioners and to government, because ultimately people have to pay for these things. I think the other thing I find sort of reassuring about it was, in some ways, it was perhaps easier, if I can put it like that, to do research 20 or 25 years ago, when any new drug that came along was compared simply to placebo, to giving calcium and vitamin D, essentially just doing nothing or a dummy drug. It's really ethically impossible to do that now. If I have patients, let's say, with new vertebral fractures, I can't have a group of several thousand patients that I just give calcium and vitamin D to any longer to compare my new drug with. I've got to give them an effective drug. So the dummy arm, if you'd want to say, or the comparator arm of trials, is no longer a placebo. It's quite an effective drug. And therefore, if you want to show your new drug is even better than that, you're going to need more patients and longer trials to show a benefit in terms of fractures. And the fact that when this is approved, and we've seen the data from SABRE and it's very impressive, if we can use improvement in bone mineral density as a surrogate outcome and get new drugs approved on that basis, then it will lead to, as you said, quicker trials, faster trials, and most importantly, getting these new drugs to my patients more effectively. And that's very exciting, you know, and it's, we talked, I think, maybe just after we switched the microphone off, you know, the story about in the big gold rush in America in the 1800s, and the people who sort of made money out of it were not the prospectors, they were those who sold the tools. And in many ways, you know, that's what Mary is doing. She's laying down the groundwork. She's selling the tools, if you want to say, for future generations of researchers, for drugs that have not yet been developed, so that they have a faster and easier and better way to show that they are efficacious for patients. And that's really exciting and really important.
Yeah, the most important research in research is researching research.
Well, isn't that exactly?
Really inspiring episode. Listeners, I really hope you enjoyed that. For our lives, our children's lives and our grandchildren's lives, the work that we heard about today is going to have a massive effect, and that's really wonderful.
So we hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. We hope you've enjoyed all the podcasts from 2025. If this is your first, then do go back and have a listen to all the amazing people we have spoken to and all the really interesting things we have spoken to them about. And we hope we will see you in 2026.
Until then, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Bye now.